KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Tlinédi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. The tidelands where our studios sit are now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots, but they were once an embarking point for fishing and hunting grounds and gatherings in other villages, as well as a place where children played on the beaches and learned to row in the harbor. In sharing this history, KTOO hopes to honor the ancestors and the descendants of the Occoquan. We recognize those families who have never relinquished their ownership and stewardship of their land and waterways and continue to cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront for today and for future generations. We'd like to take a moment and say thank you to the individuals who helped us craft our daily land acknowledgement. Gunach Chish, Chavira Starboard, who planted the idea of making it super place-specific and guided us on pronunciation. Lillian Petershore, who created so much of the beautiful structure. Ishmael Hope, who gave us additional ideas, and Ernestine Hayes, Bob Sam, and Fran Houston, who also gave important feedback. We are grateful to all those offering guidance as we grow as an organization. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Southeast Alaska is currently in the midst of an outbreak, and I am not talking about COVID-19 for a change. Dr. Elizabeth Graham, a U.S. Forest Service entomologist, has been tracking this one, and it's the topic of her evening at Egan presentation this Friday night. Hello, Dr. Graham. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here today. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. As you said, my name is Elizabeth Graham, and I'm an entomologist with the Forest Service, and I'm based here in Juneau at the Forestry Sciences Lab.
And your specialty is forest health protection. What does that mean exactly?
Well, forest health protection is a division of the Forest Service, and many people aren't aware of it, but it's actually really important section of the Forest Service where our mission is to monitor the health of the forest and provide information to the landowners and managers so that we can protect our forests and have the most healthy environment. And we do that by doing different surveys, whether we fly aerial surveys or we do our ground surveys, and we look for damage from insects, diseases, invasive plants. And we report all that information on our website and our forest health conditions report that goes out every year. And that way we can provide the public and landowners and managers information about what's going on in the forest.
And today you're here to tell us about your talk on the Western black-headed budworm. So for starters, what is a black-headed budworm?
Oh, yes. Western black-headed budworm is a caterpillar that we have here in our forest. It's a natural part of the forest. It's not an invasive species, and it's been here for a long time. And it feeds, as the name indicates, in the buds of the hemlock trees and occasionally on the spruce as well. And so the eggs are laid on the needles, and the caterpillars will, when the buds burst in springtime, they will feed on those new buds and then on the new needles. And so people here in Juneau are probably seeing some of the damage from the caterpillars, but not even realizing it just yet. Which is why I'm happy to be here today and tell folks about it and at my evening at Egan on Friday.
Yeah. Well, where might we see them around Juneau? Have you noticed any place where they're really easy to spot?
Well, right now we have lots of moths flying around. And so I'm here in the valley and I see them fluttering around my house and around the just landing on any of the brushes, the bushes and stuff like that. But some really good places to see the damage has been going up the John Muir Trail and Spalding Meadows. There's some hemlock in there that have been, they were first defoliated by the hemlock sawfly in 2019, and now they've been defoliated by the budworm as well. And so that's one area with really heavy damage, as well as the Montana Creek area and Lena Beach. There's also some feeding. And so one of the things that if you just kind of start looking for it, you'll notice it.
So you refer to them as a defoliator, which is a fun word to say. If I had to guess, I'd say that probably means they cause plants, or in this case, trees, to lose their foliage. Is that right?
Yeah, well, and they cause it by actually feeding on them. So we call them actually wasteful feeders because they will start chewing on the needles, typically on hemlock, but they'll also feed on spruce and some other conifers, especially when they're this abundant right now. And so we call them wasteful feeders because they'll start feeding on the needles and they will sometimes only feed about halfway through. And then they tie the needles together in these little shelters that they feed inside of as caterpillars, and keep them protected there. And then what this does is those needles that are sort of half chewed get this red appearance, and then they're on the tips of the branches. So it kind of gives this, the tree, this very red and glowing look. And in some cases, it can look like, you know, the tree is almost completely defoliated without any needles. But in most cases, when you get up closer, you can see that there's actually still some left behind.
So we're in the midst of an outbreak of this Western black-headed budworm right now here in the Tongass, but it's hardly the first one. How often do they occur?
So I'm going to talk a lot about this on Friday. We have a history of these caterpillars rising into outbreak mode. And so the last one took place back in the 90s, and it wasn't as extensive as the one that took place back in the 1950s. And that one was reported to have impacted nearly every acre of Southeast Alaska. And so there's some really fun and kind of mind-blowing stats from that outbreak, such as there were researchers on the Juneau ice field, and they were recording about 65 moths per square foot on the ice field up there. And there were so many moths flying around 2,000 feet that it was obscuring visibility on flights flying from out of Petersburg. And so some pretty wild things. And so we're not quite at that level yet, but we recorded over 500,000 acres of damage this year during our aerial surveys from budworm feeding. And so the indications are that this will probably continue. That outbreaks usually last for several years, like 2 years, 3 years, maybe a little bit more. And then what'll happen is that there's all these natural control mechanisms that will keep the population in check. And so, you know, right now there's not a lot of those control mechanisms. And those are things like there's a virus that impacts the caterpillars. There's a fungus. There's several parasitic wasps and predators, but they need some time to catch up to a population this big in order for it to knock down. So what we have is these big outbreaks that seem like they kind of come out of nowhere, and then they'll bust, and we call it boom and bust, and then we don't see them again for several decades.
So that's good news that, one, this is not an invasive species, and two, the outbreaks kind of implode on themselves eventually, and there's no need to take measures to stop it. But that sounds like it's pretty pretty high impact. What is the impact of an outbreak?
Well, it can be high impact. This is a what we would call a disturbance event in our forest, and that it's going to cause some changes. And one of the biggest things we'll see is what we call top kill. And that's where the top portion of the tree dies. And you may see this in the forest already, where, you know, you've got hemlocks with dead tops, and so the rest of the tree, you know, withstands, but that top portion doesn't. And then the most extreme impact will be if the whole tree is killed. And there are areas that we have seen this. In 2018 and 2019, we had an outbreak of the hemlock sawfly, which feeds on the older hemlock needles. And so now we've had this budworm on top feeding on the newer needles. There are some places where the trees just haven't been able to withstand. And so it's not the norm, but there is some areas where we will see mortality.
That sounds like pretty bad news. Is that the case?
I don't want to say bad or good. You know, it's, our forests are dynamic, and they, you know, need to, there should be some change that happens. And, you know, when some trees die, it creates a gap, and that opens up more light, and, you know, it allows space for new trees to grow and understory, and great for the berry crops underneath. It's part of the changing forest. And so, in other areas of the country, our forests have fire that comes through as a disturbance agent, or different bark beetles and things like that. But, you know, we don't have a lot of that here. So this is, you know, kind of what helps create those changes.
Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Graham, and black-headed budworms are the topic of her Evening at Egan lecture this Friday. Dr. Graham, I don't want you to give too much more away here, but in addition to what you've already shared, what do you plan to cover in your talk, or what sort of multimedia do you plan to present?
I'm going to talk a lot about some of the historical documents we have from this outbreak back in the 50s. There was just some really interesting things they tried doing back then that we definitely wouldn't try doing now. And then I'll also talk about some of the modern techniques that we have. We've moved into a world of using remote sensing instead of just flying in ground surveys for monitoring this outbreak. And that's pretty awesome. And then also, you know, we're relying a lot on the public these days, sort of crowdsourcing our observations. And they've become very valuable in helping us track outbreaks, not just of the Western black-headed budworm, but of other insects and diseases and stuff like that. And so what I really encourage your listeners and anyone else is to start using the iNaturalist app. It's a great tool that you can download on your phone. And then if you see, you know, a cool insect or, you know, just something that you're kind of interested in, know what it is, you can upload the photos to that app. And if it's something that we're interested in, like a black-headed budworm, we'll actually get a tag on it and know that you recorded it and uploaded it and where it was. So it's a great tool for both the public and to learn more, and then for us to be able to use that information.
Oh, yeah, that does sound like fun. I'd love to play around with that. Well, fascinating stuff, Dr. Elizabeth Graham, U.S. Forest Service entomologist. And thank you so much for such an interesting conversation. Your talk is this Friday, October 1st, 7 p.m. via Zoom. You can register and get the link at uas.alaska.edu/Egan lecture. Is there anything else you wanted to say to our audience today before we say goodbye?
No, that's all. I really appreciate being here. And again, I just encourage folks to be observant and report your observations. And, you know, what you might not think is important could be really valuable to someone else.
Well, I hope all goes well with this fall and the budworms, and looking forward to hearing more about all that at your presentation this Friday. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. When you see Matt Robus's carved birds perched on a piece of driftwood or a slab of rock, you will be fooled into thinking it's real, and that's partly the point. He's here now to tell us about his exhibit of bird carvings this first Friday. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Shelley.
Hi, welcome to the show. Matt, let's dive right in. How did you first get started carving birds?
Although I knew a little bit about decoys from growing up on the East Coast, when I lived here in Juneau, my son took a 4-H course that involved carving a decoy. And because they had a bunch of kids in the room with sharp instruments, they liked to have parents there as well. And so they offered a piece of wood or a piece of cork to some of the parents. And I just got hooked. I started carving and just decided that was the way I'd like to spend my spare time.
Mm. Would you describe your process for us? What kind of wood do you use, or something else? What kind of paint?
Sure. I mostly use the type of wood one would use in decoys. And so things like red cedar or redwood, things that are resistant to weathering and can stand being out in the weather and salt water and so forth. And so the carving is of woods like that, and then I use acrylic paints. It's basically a plastic coating when you're done, and so that's pretty weather resistant as well.
And how else is your work related to the tradition of making decoys?
I started out wanting to make literal hunting decoys, duck decoys, for my own use, and you can only make so many of those before you have too many. And so I started looking around for other options and realized, you know, there is this big tradition, not in Alaska, but on the East Coast and in the Mississippi Valley and on the West Coast, of carving decoys back in the days when sport hunting and market hunting were big things in the late 19th and middle up to the middle of the 20th century. And I liked the technique. And so I took the technique into birds that used to be carved for decoys, but are no longer huntable. And then after doing a bunch of sandpiper type birds, shorebirds, I decided, you know, I could use the same techniques for songbirds and anything, any kind of bird really. And so what the show is about really is taking the techniques of decoy carving and painting and moving them beyond literal hunting decoys. There will be a few hunting decoys in the show, but taking it into shorebirds and songbirds, and you know, there would be a raven there and a cormorant and all sorts of things that you don't think of as decoys. And I have decoys in the name of my little business, so people are always thinking I'm just carving things for hunting, but it's taking the technique into all sorts of other birds for, you know, decorative purposes, for the type of birds people like to see on their mantle or on their bureau at home.
Well, you've clearly got a talent for the medium. And for folks who might like to see some pictures, they're up at kto.org/JunoAfternoon. However, you're also a scientist. What is your scientific specialty?
Well, there's lots of people that say I wasn't much of a scientist, but I'm a trained wildlife biologist, and I spent 30 years in Alaska working as a wildlifer, both for the Bureau of Land Management for a few years, and then a fairly long career with the Wildlife Conservation Division of the Department of Fish and Game, and ended up in headquarters here in Juneau. But I've been retired now since 2007, so I've had plenty of time to play around with taking photos of birds or pictures of birds I find elsewhere and turning them into something that's three-dimensional, and that's what it'll be at Jack this Friday.
So how does your background in science get applied to your artistic process?
It's interesting. If anything, you know, I was not a bird scientist. I was mostly doing big game, and birds were more of a fun thing for me. And I guess the thing is, it's really not that scientific. It's more, I guess, artistic or aesthetic, and that is taking a simple block of wood and carving it to make people think about the bird. It gives you the feel of the bird without being super, super detailed. And that's really important to my process, which you asked about before. Back when people were making decoys for a living, they could not afford to spend extra time on making all sorts of super realistic details. And so they found the sweet spot where they could do some work and make a bird that made you and made other birds think about a particular species without all sorts of extra detail work. And you will see, if you come see these birds at this exhibition, these are not highly detailed. Hopefully I have done just enough in terms of carving the shape and painting the colors to make you recognize the bird and think that the bird looks like it's not just a stiff little, you know, dead carving. It's got a little bit of life to it. That's my goal.
Your exhibit, as we mentioned, opens this first Friday at the Jack, and I understand there will be more than 50 carvings on display. So once you finish with a bird, how do you decide which one you want to do next?
Boy, it's a little bit random. I see a photo with a posture that strikes me and I go for it. Or a lot of my work now is commissioned work. So somebody will say that they would want a particular species, and then I'll start doing a little research and try to carve it out. And usually it comes out somewhat looking like what they wanted. So it's certainly not a well-organized, thoughtful process. It's just kind of what strikes me as a fun thing to do next.
What are some of the species that we'll spot if we come and check out your exhibit?
Well, I will have a bunch of mallards there just for those who want to see duck decoys. And then I have some sea ducks. I'll have a Barrow's Golden Eye and a couple of long-tailed ducks, which used to be called Old Squaw. And there will be quite a few shorebirds of different kinds. There will be yellow legs and various plovers and, what else, turnstones. And then the weird things, which are kind of wonderful, in my opinion, there's a pelagic cormorant. People usually don't think of cormorants as a featured decorative bird. But I think if you see the curves on this one, you'll agree it can be, pretty aesthetic, pretty nice looking. I'm just thinking through the room there. I will actually have an unfinished curlew on a carving vise, and we're going to ask people to do a silent auction, and the winner will get to have me finish the bird for them. And then I have everything from a Wilson's warbler to several great blue herons, full-sized herons, and just a host more. There'll be 53 birds there, 32 of them for sale. And one of the really cool things for me personally is 21 of the birds are being loaned back to me by people who have bought them in the past. And it's been really wonderful having them back in the house. It's like having kids home from college. It's just really, really fun to be able to see what I've done in the past. So it's been great pulling the show together.
How long has it taken you to make all 53 of those carved birds?
That's a difficult question to answer. The oldest bird there is a mallard. Several of the mallards were carved in 1996, and other birds were carved within the last 6 months. Most of the birds for sale were carved in 2019, preparing for the show that was supposed to happen in August of 2020. And then since we had to put the show off till now, I've carved a few birds over the winter. And now it's just a big pile of 53 birds.
I know you love them all, and I'm sure they are all beautiful, but do you have any favorites?
Yes, in this show, personally, I think that pelagic cormorant is one of the best birds I've ever done. There is a whimbrel that I gave to my daughter and son-in-law for their wedding present, 5 or 7 years ago now, that is a really nice bird that'll be there. So those are two of the favorites. The great blue herons are pretty fun because they're all in different postures. There's going to be, I think, 5 different great blue herons there. And one thing I haven't said is that these are all hand carved. And so when you hand carve a full-sized heron, you know that you've done some work. It is a lot to do with nothing but knives and chisels and rasps. It takes a while and you go to bed sore after a week or two of hacking away on one of those things. So I'm very happy with those, and I think they're very beautiful.
What's the next bird or birds you'd like to carve, apart from the one that you have in progress that is the subject of the silent auction?
Shorebirds are always very interesting, but I also love waterfowl. I guess I don't have anything. I've been so focused on trying to pull all these birds together and get ready for the show. I haven't looked ahead. I do have one request for a northern cardinal that I'll be doing once I get free from the show. Generally, I like to do Alaskan species, but if somebody has a reason to make a different species for another part of the country or the world, I will certainly do that. As a matter of fact, I did 3 birds this last year that are now in Australia that were on a special request. So I'll try anything at least once.
I can see the heron, I think it's a blue heron over your shoulder. It's certainly a big bird there. Do you carve any of the smaller birds like the hummingbirds?
I do. I will have one hummingbird in the show. I've done quite a few hummingbirds in the past when I was over at the Juno Artist Gallery. So it spans the distance from hummingbird life size to great blue heron life size. So there's a huge range there.
Well, that'd be neat to see. And although these are carved sort of in the traditional decoy, carved in the tradition of the decoy, are any of them actually functional as decoys?
Yes, actually, the six mallards that I have in the show are in a tub. And right now they're on artificial plywood water, but I did float them. And they could be taken out and used by a hunter tomorrow. There's also a couple of brant decoys. And I guess of the birds that are legal to hunt these days, those would be the only birds in the show that are legitimate decoys. Birds that used to be hunted, like a lot of the shorebirds, I have several, probably over a half dozen shorebird decoys, quote unquote, that look like the decoys of old, but are not usable for hunting anymore because of the regulations.
Where do you hope that your birds, your children, if you will, are going to end up as part of this exhibit?
Well, my fond hope would be people would like them as decorative objects in their home. They're all made to withstand weather, so you could literally take some of them and put them out on a porch or whatever. But I would expect that if people either liked a particular species and or liked the way that they were presented at this show, could take them and put them in their house as a decorative piece. People don't do that maybe as much as they used to, but I still think if you like birds and like wildlife, this is a way to have a piece of that inside your house.
Well, I do think that people in Juneau like birds quite a bit. Thanks, Matt Robus, both scientist and artist. I hope your first Friday opening is a big success. Is there anything you want to mention about the exhibit, COVID restrictions, things like that?
I do. Thank you for that. When we designed this exhibit to be in October, we did not expect the situation we have right now. We thought it would be back to normal, but it isn't. Mm-hmm. So the Jack is opening up. This is going to be the reopening of the Jack on Friday. And they're going to require masks inside. There will be a controlled flow of people through the gallery so that there won't be a crowd. And you're also going to need to bring proof of vaccination, like a picture of your card on a phone or something like that. Those are reasonable expectations, I think, under the circumstances where, the Delta variant has caused so much illness in town now. So 4:30 to 7 Friday night, and if you wear a mask and show that you've been vaccinated, I look forward to seeing you come through the tightly packed gallery full of birds.
And probably a rare opportunity to see so many of your birds in one place. Well, thank you so much for this wonderful interview. I really appreciated talking with you. It was great to hear your answers, and thank you for answering all of my questions. Anything else you'd like to share before we say goodbye today?
No, I thank you for letting me talk about it, and I really look forward to seeing people who are interested in what I'm doing. And if you want to talk about carving, I could take the rest of the evening doing that. So I'll see people on Friday night.
All right. Well, take care and have a nice afternoon. Have a great exhibit on Friday. Hope you have a good turnout.
Thank you, Shelley.
Up next, mapping out the future for two of Juneau's most popular recreation areas, Montana Creek and Fish Creek. Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. The City and Borough of Juneau's Parks and Recreation Department is in the process of developing master plans for both Montana Creek and Fish Creek Park. And here to give us an update on that is Michelle Elfers, Deputy Director of Parks and Recreation. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. And thanks for being here with us today. Let's get started and dive right in with Montana Creek. I was wondering if you could just give us a general overview of the process that you're working through to develop its master plan. What are sort of the steps that you're following?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Thanks for asking. So we are looking at a master plan for the Montana Creek area, and that is a pretty big area that encompasses the project area we're looking at encompasses the area from Montana Creek Road north up to Windfall Creek area, and then west all the way basically through Spalding Meadows to Glacier Highway, and then to the east, just to the ridge line before the ice field of Glacier. So it's a big area, and there's three land managing agencies involved in that area. So DNR with the state, the U.S. Forest Service, and CBJ. So we're all working together on that with Trail Mix involved too. And our first step was back in August. We put out just an informal survey to the community asking about how people currently use the area for recreation and how they'd like to use the area. So we got those results back. There's a report actually with those results for anyone who wants to take a look at it on our Parks and Rec page. So it's juno.org, the city website. And if you go to Parks and Rec, it says Montana Creek Master Plan. And if you click there, you'll see the report. And we had over 1,000 responses to the survey. So there was quite a lot of interest in that survey. We're really excited and got some really good information. And with that information, what we're doing now is just plotting a course for the next steps in the process. And we've started to meet with user groups. So there's a lot of groups like the Archery Club and the Hank Harmon Public Range Board and Territorial Sportsmen and Trout Unlimited and Alaska Native groups like SHI and DIA, and we've reached out to these groups to start a conversation and say, hey, you know, how do you use this area? How do your members use this area? How should we approach this process, you know, to, and what outcomes do we want? So we're really in the early stages of information gathering in the process right now, and we'll be moving ahead as we go through these smaller meetings to some meetings with the general public, some looking at, as we gather the information about what types of improvements people want to see, you know, where those should go, start to spatially locate those and integrate the different ideas across the area. So we hope that in the next few months, we'll have some concept plans to discuss with the public and look at and get feedback from them on.
Well, what are some of the proposed changes that could be part of the master planning document?
Well, I can tell you what some of the main feedback from the survey we've received. So we've heard a lot about making more connections. So as I said, it's a big area, but, you know, the Montana Creek Valley connects from the valley all the way, Mendenhall Valley, all the way up to the Windfall area, which connects over to Eagle Beach and Amalga. So there's some really strong connections. There's a old trail there that needs some improvement. It also connects up to Spalding Meadows, which gets a lot of use all year round, but there's a lot of people who Nordic ski up there, who snowmobile up there. So making those connections as well as possibly connecting to the Mendenhall Glacier Recreation Area. People are really interested in linking those through trail systems and through, you know, current and future recreation. So that's something we'll be looking really closely at in the plan.
Will you be doing anything in the short term for this coming winter?
So we are working. What's been really nice about this master plan that it's gotten the Forest Service, CBJ, and DNR, the three managing agencies, meeting regularly to talk about the area. And one of the big pieces of feedback we got from the survey as well was that we need better communication of existing regulations for use in that area and just more clarity in what's allowed and what's not allowed. And so we've been starting that conversation about how to get that message out. We've developed some signage we're going to put up in the area, and we're starting to talk about how to manage it. There's definitely some things we know we need more parking. We heard that loud and clear in the survey, and we've heard that from all and that's we're not going to be able to build new parking lots by this winter, but we are thinking about how to manage parking and how to deal with that. So we know that we're not going to solve all the problems this winter, but we hope that with a plan we can start prioritizing and working away at them over the next couple of years.
Great. Well, now looking at Fish Creek Park, first of all, what areas are encompassed or what areas are considered a part of Fish Creek Park?
Well, so there's a Fish Creek Park that's a parks and recreation land, and that's a little over 50 acres. And when you head out North Douglas Highway on the water side, it's just past Eagle Crest Road and Bayview. The park is right there. And that the CBJ Park is mostly the uplands area, so not the estuary. But actually then the whole estuary tidal area with the creeks and the ponds that are out there are mostly on state-managed land. So it's the Mendenhall State Game Refuge managed by Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So when we're talking about the master plan, we're actually talking about both of those areas, the state and the city land. And the way that that plan got started was we have an older master plan for the area, but it's over a decade old. And so we knew that we needed to look at it a little more closely from the parks and recreation standpoint. And then the Southeast Alaska Watershed Coalition has been really looking at that area for some environmental rehabilitation of the old gravel pond area and saw some opportunities for creating some wetland and some estuary, tidal estuary land out there. So they approached us and said, hey, we're looking at this. And we said, hey, we also want to look at our recreational opportunities. And both of those really intersect. And so we're working together with the state and SOC and CBJ on that plan.
Great. And what are some of the possible proposed changes that could be a part of that master plan?
Yeah, well, the same as Montana Creek, we did a survey as well this summer and had a few hundred, maybe 350, 450 respondents to that survey, which was great. And big things we heard in that were restrooms. A lot of people want more restrooms. They also want to consider that, you know, there's a lot of fishing that happens out there and it's pretty heavy in kind of July and May, June, July time. And so there's really a kind of hygiene cleanliness issue, right? We need to figure out how to manage the fish waste that happens because then animals come in and there's lots going on. So really looking at all of the different types of uses and how we can allow for those uses, keep a clean, safe area, you know, maybe put some shelters, right? Picnic shelters, some day use shelters out there. So we've heard a variety of things about how we can improve the area, which are pretty exciting.
I'm curious as to how much sway community input has on some of the final decisions for these projects when as they move forward. For example, right now, Capitol Park is under construction. I know there was a request for public comments in the months before they began. Did any of that result in changes to the plan?
Yeah, so we actually also did a survey for Capitol Park. And we took that information, yeah, and directly put it into the plan. There had been an older master plan that we started from on Capitol Park, did the survey and then updated it based on the responses. You know, we asked things about play areas and basketball courts. The older master plan didn't have a basketball court. We heard from people that a basketball court was really important, that it's a great area for all ages, but especially teenagers. So we made sure to keep the basketball court. We made sure to keep the sledding hill area. Also we heard from people that they really like picnicking and lunch and, you know, yes, it's good to have kid play area, but also having some quiet area. So, we've improved some of the opportunities for, picnicking over on the downhill side of the park. So, you know, in the master plans are a really good opportunity that don't have a lot of constraints yet because there's not a budget set. They're really a visioning process. So for Fish Creek and Montana Creek, I mean, it's really driven by what people are telling us right now. I mean, that's how we're driving this process. So at this point, it's all public input to figure out how to move forward on both of those plans.
That's great. You've touched on this some already, but how can residents get involved in the planning process? What opportunities are there right now?
So right now, the best thing to do is go to our Parks and Recreation webpage. So if you go to juno.org, and then you can, in the departments, pull down Parks and Recreation. And right there, it'll say Montana Creek Master Plan and Fish Creek Master Plan. So check out those pages. There's some information there. I think my email, there's a couple emails for contact if you want to put in a comment right now. But that's where we'll post when we have meetings and further opportunities for engagement. You can read the reports on the surveys. We'd love to hear your thoughts. If you didn't get to participate in the survey, like by all means, just send me what you think and we will add it to our comments. But there will be upcoming meetings. We generally send out info releases. We posted the Parks and Rec Facebook page, and they'll also be located on the web pages for that information.
Thanks for all the updates, Michelle Elfers, Deputy Director of CBJ's Parks and Recreation Department. We have just like a little less than a minute left. Is there anything else you wanted to share before we say goodbye?
Oh, sure. Just on a totally different note, Capitol Park is under construction. So swing by and take a look. It's a complex project with lots of great improvements. So we'll be constructing through next July. The completion date's August 1st. But please take a look. We're excited about the changes happening.
Yes, I am as well. Thanks again, Michelle.
Thank you.
Take care.